Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 19th of December, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your hosts, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. Gavin.
Gav the Chav himself. Yes, Gavin Williamson has made a statement to Parliament on the modernising defence programme. It's £1.8 billion, an initiative begun in January, apparently, or will begin in January, to strengthen the armed forces. He said that there would be increased focus on cutting-edge technologies like AI and so on to keep so the UK can keep pace with competitors and adversaries. And on screen there, we've got the quote. In July, I made a statement setting out headline conclusions from 6 months of work in the modernising defence programme. Since then, work has continued apace. He went on to say that to help achieve these goals, we will establish a permanent net assessment unit, as well as a defence policy board of external experts to bring challenge to defence policy and defence strategy. So there you go. We're going to go into a little bit of detail on this, but a defence policy board of external experts, is that going to include people like Chris Donnelly from the Institute for Statecraft, who seems to be also a senior advisor for the Defence Select Committee at the moment, and all kinds of other roles that he has in government. But anyway, let's have a look at some of the detail of this then. So here's the document, Mobilising, Modernising and Transforming Defence. And let's start off with this contribution to the fusion doctrine. Our adversaries are using a wide range of non-military methods to target UK interests. Defence is working ever most closely with our intelligence agencies and the National Crime Agency to deter and disrupt hostile state activity and to deal with the threats posed by organised crime. Is organised crime, Brian, traditionally fall under the remit of defence?
Absolutely not.
Yes, at home and overseas, we support the Home Office in delivering the government's counter-terrorism strategy contest. We provide specialist manpower to help deal with domestic contingencies from flooding and severe weather to chemical weapons attacks. And of course, as we've heard in the last few days, domestic contingencies would also include Brexit. So they're getting prepared for potentially a hard Brexit, a no-deal Brexit in March. And then it goes on to say, overseas, we support the efforts of the Foreign Office, Department for International Development and Department for International Trade in delivering our national security and prosperity objectives. So Ministry of War is now involved in delivering prosperity objectives. That's good. Let's see what else they say. 6 years ago, we created the Joint Forces Command to work alongside the single services. We're now reviewing the Joint Forces Command to improve how we operate in an era of constant competition. A stronger JFC will help us outthink our adversaries and to innovate and operate faster. It will integrate and orchestrate our strategic capabilities within the armed forces across government and with our allies. So they're going to integrate and orchestrate strategic capabilities within the armed forces across government. So this is not just Ministry of Defence anymore. It's other agencies and other departments. And with our allies, well, this, of course, means the European Union. The document itself doesn't mention the European Union explicitly. It mentions NATO quite a bit. But, of course, we've got to see this in the context of the NATO and EU relationship, which is being forged by Jens Stoltenberg and Federica Mogherini. He goes on to say that stronger JFC will better position defence for future conflict, galvanising our ability to think, train and operate, and it will improve the integration of offensive cyber across our armed forces and the rest of government, providing advantage in the new information-rich environment. We will provide further details next year. And I have to admit, Brian, this particular statement caught me by surprise. They are admitting here to having deployed offensive cyber across the rest of government. I wasn't aware that the Department for Work and Pensions, for example, would be carrying out offensive cyber attacks. That seems to be what it's saying. Am I misreading that?
No, I don't think so, Mike, but we'll come on to, in just a minute, we'll discuss a little bit of the language, because somebody's already picked this up in our chat box saying, more or less, it's rubbish. Who thinks up this rubbish? But of course, we're seeing this very cloaked language, aren't we, where you listen to it, you look at the paragraphs, you look at the sentences. Some of it simply doesn't make sense to somebody applying normal common sense to it. But obviously in political circles, it makes sense. And what is the agenda? So we can dig into that a bit, I think.
Well, indeed. So let's move on then. Here's the next one. Looking ahead, conflict and competition will increasingly hinge on smarter, better informed decision making. We're building a strategic net assessment capability for this purpose, run by a permanent net assessment unit. Strategic net assessment looks across all dimensions of military competition to assess how the capability choices of both friends and foes may play out over the short, medium and long term. Its conclusions can be used to develop more nuanced and better informed defence strategy so we can better anticipate our adversaries' actions and counter them more effectively. To test the potential of the capability, we undertook a pilot study into the military strategic balance in the High North, and we are developing an Arctic strategy for defence as a consequence. And the thing that struck me, first of all, about that, Brian, was that this is something we should be doing anyway, and it's something I believe we have been doing anyway. So if this type of planning and this type of preparation for scenarios is something that we're doing anyway, why do we need a strategic net assessment capability? What this looks like to me is that they are running a massive reorganization behind the scenes, that they're trying to present a plausible explanation for why they're doing it. But in fact, when you look a bit closer, the explanation isn't very plausible, because this new capability is something that we've had for decades. In fact, forever, really.
Well, we could say forever, but let's say we've certainly had it while we've been involved in NATO, because, of course, NATO couldn't undertake any operation without that scenario having been thought through, it having been put down on paper, what used to be called an operation order. So there was an assessment of the threat, there was an assessment of blue forces, the defence forces that could be put up against that threat. And all of this was played out in scenarios, and then the plan was formulated so that if trouble erupted, let's say that Europe needed reinforcing from America, that everybody knew what was going to happen. That is the only way you can fight major conflict, and all those plans are already in place via NATO. So this is cloaked language, where the UK is now working behind the scenes, it seems, with other partners in order to rethink all of this strategy. And it seems to me that can be only one partner that is the UK is working with, and that's the European Union. So one hand is saying we are not duplicating NATO, but actually they are duplicating NATO.
Right. And that's half the picture. And the other half of the picture is this cross-government fusion doctrine approach. They are reorganizing things, merging, blurring lines between departments, blurring areas of sort of limits that departments have traditionally worked in.
Yeah.
And it then becomes very difficult to know who is making decisions and what the scope of those decisions might be, or what the implications of those decisions might be.
Yeah, this is absolutely happening. We're going to move on to a little bit more to show people that this is what's happening. But was there a debate in Parliament that we were going to drastically change the way our Ministry of Defence operated? No.
No.
So all that's happened is that all of a sudden Gavin Williamson is coming out with policy which will have come straight out of the Cabinet Office and the so-called Pearl Room, the mixture between the Cabinet Office and big business. And now this is being pushed out in very, very careful, very well-crafted language, so that people don't really understand that the whole fabric of our government is being changed.
Now, just before we move on to the final point here, of course, this, as we began by saying this, Gavin Williamson did go to Parliament with this document. He did make a statement to Parliament, but what's striking is that there doesn't seem to have been much pushback from the opposition. There's no questions being asked about this. It's generally just being accepted as what has to happen, which is a little surprising perhaps. But let's come back to this point. In parallel, we will create a defence policy board of external experts to bring fresh perspectives and challenge as the department makes policy and strategy, combined with a reorganisation that has strengthened the department's security policy and operations area and sharpened the strategy area. These steps will help us to improve our performance in this crucial area of the business. And this was the key point out of this paragraph, I think, this crucial area of our business. So this is how they view what they're doing as a business. I guess they've got to make a profit, but certainly it is a business. And does that mean that interventionist wars or ramping up rhetoric with Russia is simply a business decision?
Well, I think that's becoming more and more true, Mike, and we're going to have a look at some other little clips to do with Parliament and who's been advising people. But of course, if you dig into it, the people brought into Westminster to talk to the Defence Select Committee, we're seeing more and more connections back through the think tanks to the industrial military complex. So we're looking at RAND, or we're looking at Lockheed Martin, or we're looking at Boeing. So these actors behind the scenes who make money out of the war and death are actually the people now being brought into central government to form policy. They don't sit on the sidelines, they're now being integrated. And when you talked about this earlier on, what came into my mind is it was only a few months ago that Theresa May said she was forming I think it was 5 business councils, where she's bringing people in the corporate sector right alongside government to make policy. So the voter doesn't know anymore whether they're dealing with policy that's come out of a democratic process through their MPs and an impartial civil service. That used to be the system, albeit with some faults. Now we've got this very blurry mess. We don't know who's forming the policy.
This isn't suddenly. I mean, Theresa May mentioned fusion doctrine for the first time this year, but this has been going on for quite some time. So let's go back to 2016 and One Public Estate. And this was the excuse that really the amount of property that the government was owning and managing was really too expensive and its carbon footprint was too big. And that really we would have to merge local government and central government in this case to try to limit, or so they could sell off some space and would limit the amount of building infrastructure that they would have to manage. So this was One Public Estate, and they were inviting new and existing partnerships to apply for this, putting forward ambitious and credible work programmes to be delivered in collaboration with other public sector partners in their areas. More of this type of Aesopian language. And it was all about councils in England moving into other government buildings, government departments sharing buildings with councils and so on. This was announced by the Cabinet Office. 159 councils were involved and so on. And this is what Ben Gummer had to say at the time. My team are working closely with government departments to ensure that One Public Estate is helping to deliver government priorities such as health and social care integration and rationalisation of the defence estate. Well, let's come right up to date then. And today the State of the Estate 2018 report has been launched by Oliver Dowden, who is the current Cabinet Office Minister. And they have the report apparently shows that the size of the government estate has been reduced by 156,000 square metres over the past 12 months. And apparently that's equivalent to 13 Trafalgar Squares. So that's really impressive stuff. That is £750 million they've brought in from disposing of 400 sites. And apparently carbon emissions from government buildings across the country were cut by 39%, with paper and water consumption also reduced. So this is fantastic stuff. As Oliver Dowden says, transforming the government estate to make it operate more efficiently and save taxpayers' money is clearly something to be proud of. But at the back of this is this fusion where we bring departments in amongst each other and people are working together and we don't really know who's working for whom anymore. And so it goes on. But we don't need to worry, Brian, because apparently working with the Barn Owl Conservation Network, the military has put up more than 2,000 owl nest boxes on prison land over the past 18 months as part of this programme. So it's not all bad.
It's not all bad. My comment on this is if we just take the defence estate, they're crowing about the success of rationalising defence estate, bringing it all together, which is making cost savings. But of course, in strategic defence terms, this is utter nonsense, because the more you bring everything together, the more you bring it into one big target so that everything can be wiped out in one go. Mm. During the Second World War, things were dispersed. They were dispersed deliberately to make it difficult to find the particular sites that were doing whatever they were doing. And of course, very sensitive material or magazines were buried in the ground to make sure that they couldn't be hit. So what you're actually doing by rationalizing in a business sense is actually making your strategic defense estate immensely vulnerable, particularly now we've got precision guided weapons. But nobody talks about that. It's just what the cost savings will be. Well, let's have a look at this document or letter that was sent through to us, and I'm going to say thank you very much. It's this sort of information that that is so important in helping to explain what's going on. So it's a letter from the Euro-Atlantic Security Policy. It's dated the 5th of December 2018, and it's been sent through to a gentleman. Now, I won't read it all. You can freeze it on screen to see, but we'll just do a little bit. It says, "Dear Mr. X, thank you for your email of 7th November 2018 addressed to the Secretary of State for Defence, in which you've expressed concerns regarding the UK's future security relationship with the European Union. Your email has been passed to me for response. The Prime Minister has made it clear that the UK's exit from the EU will not lessen our commitment to European security and defence. The UK supports a strong, secure and successful EU with global reach and influence that can help address our shared priorities. Your concerns reflect recent inaccurate reporting of the EU's permanent structured cooperation. PESCO is intended to help EU member states develop the military capabilities they need to respond to the range of threats Europe faces." And so it goes on. What we found from reading through this is that basically this is all the truth really put upside down. I'll scroll it up so that you can freeze the rest of it on screen and read it in your own time as well. So it says towards the end, turning to your specific concern regarding the UK's control of its armed forces, I can assure you that under no circumstances would the UK surrender control of our armed forces to anybody. What is necessary is for national armed forces to be able to work together effectively when they're called upon to act. And fundamental to our approach is for the EU's contribution to defence and security to be complementary to and respect the role of NATO, which is the cornerstone of our defence. Goes on to say, I hope this letter is helpful. So in this letter, Mike, we've really got it. Here, the government is saying we're working with NATO. But of course, you've just taken us through a segment where you've shown quite clearly that actually there is another agenda going on under the surface. And that is this full military unification with the EU, which requires a full and new EU worldwide policy to be developed. But did you notice this on the letter? The start was this very interesting segment which said, thank you for your email. Your email has been passed to me for response. But by the time you get to the end of the letter, it says, I hope this letter is helpful. Yours sincerely, blank, Joint Unit on Euro-Atlantic Security Policy. So the letter has been written, has been compiled by a human being, a person.
Well, you assume so, but well, Gavin Williamson says we're going to be using more and more AI.
So. Well, it could be AI. So let's dig into this and say, so what is happening here is that you've received a letter which is simply saying, trust us. It purports to come from, I'm going to say, from a human being. But by the time you get to the end, it's simply anonymous and it's the department itself which is responding. I find this very, very sinister. We did call the department to see if they could explain this, but the media team got very flustered. They said they would call us back. I suggested that probably wouldn't happen. And
quick as a flash, nothing
has occurred. So we went to have a little look to see what we could find out about this unit. And we came upon on this one, witnesses speaking to one of the defence committees. And here we've got some interesting things, because on Tuesday, the 22nd of May, 2018, we've got Gavin Williamson Secretary of State for Defence is one witness, coupled with Giles Ahern, head of MOD FCO Joint Unit on Euro-Atlantic Security Policy. So it wasn't very easy to find out who the actual people were behind this very strange Euro-Atlantic unit. But by doing a little bit of digging, we were able to start to get a look at them. So this, I think, is the gentleman talking at a NATO Defence College meeting back in 2016. And certainly he's been very heavily embedded in NATO. But now we know that he's also running this Euro-Atlantic policy, but apparently there's no competition with NATO. So this is the gentleman. Did he, Mike, did he actually write the letter that came back to our member of the public? We have no way of knowing. Well, we dug a little bit deeper, and this is the other name that we came up with, Simon Jones. He's the deputy head of the unit. But as you can see by the from the LinkedIn page here, that he doesn't want to identify himself with a picture. We've only got a little greyed out man. Well, it's his background that interested us, because he's been operating with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for quite some time. So, excuse me, here's some of his jobs. Head of Europe and Democracy Team. That's reassuring. Lots of democracy in Europe. Head of the Russian Team. Now, that seems to have come about because he's got a Russian language capability. But there he is, deputy head of HMG Joint Unit on Euro-Atlantic Security Policy. But if we get into his background, where is his expertise? Because he spent 5 years on EU education and training. Then he was into the Foreign and Commonwealth Office as a second secretary on negotiating EU audiovisual legislation. And then we suddenly see this very interesting move where he's become deputy head of counterterrorism strategy team. So this is key stuff, Mike, and we have to say, who are these people? To whom are they accountable? Mm-hmm. And what is their real expertise? And the deeper you dig, the more difficult it is to actually see who these people are, what their true allegiances are, but they are helping to formulate this policy. And it didn't take too long to have a look at this with another list of witnesses that we see here, where evidence is being given. The first witness was Mr. Joseph Walker Cousins, senior fellow at the Institute of Statecraft. And the second person following him is Simon Jones, the deputy head of Euro-Atlantic Security Policy Foreign Commonwealth Office. Now, they were at the same event. That doesn't prove that these men know each other well, but I somehow find it very unlikely that they're going to be called up witnesses without actually understanding who the other person was and what their particular agenda is. So civil service, I think, has disappeared, Mike.
Absolutely. And we'll have something more to say about that in a day or two. Now, The Guardian here, the headline is, Russia may have nuclear arms in Crimea. Hacked EU cables warn. Now, I'm not at first glance clear as to what these cables are, whether they're undersea cables or what sort of cables they are. But anyway, I'll just read a little bit of this. Diplomatic messages describe annexed area of Ukraine as hot zone and Trump as a bully. Brussels has launched an investigation into the apparent hacking of the EU's diplomatic communications network after thousands of cables were made public, including descriptions of Donald Trump as a bully and Crimea as a hot zone where nuclear weapons may now be present. The dump of confidential cables on a public site lays bare the concerns of EU diplomats and officials over the Trump administration and its struggle in dealing with Russia and China. Among the reports made public is a warning on 8 February that Crimea has been turned into a hot zone where nuclear warheads might have been already deployed. Now, I have to say that the author of this article isn't on any of the Integrity Initiative documents that I have seen. However, I'm going to use this article as the sort of opening salvo in a new sort of campaign that we're going to run. This is the Daily Integrity, and we're going to have a Daily Integrity report on every UK column news from now on. So we'll pick the best that we can find of, or the most ridiculous anti-Russian propaganda that we can find. But apparently nuclear warheads have already been deployed to Crimea. Maybe they have, but there's no evidence for it other than allegations of hacked cables. So there you go. What do you think?
Well, I think what we're starting to see, Mike, is we look out at massive, massive propaganda which is coming through the British government. There is no doubt about this. BBC is a key part of that team, BBC monitoring, BBC media action. And you're looking through a propaganda dark glasses. So is this stuff true? It doesn't seem to be to us. And we've got another little story in a minute. You might regard it as black humorous, but what it shows is that it's not clear where news is coming from at the moment.
Well, actually, this leads into that because, of course, what we've seen over the last number of years is increasing number of redundancies amongst journalists. So journalists are no longer employed by newspapers, and newspapers are closing. Local newspapers are closing or being merged with each other. And the question then, Brian, is where are all these journalists going? And we've had quite a number of clues over the years, but I just want to highlight this one because this came from the Integrity Initiative document dump, the third one. And this is Avisa Partners. They describe themselves as e-lobbying, online advocacy. And let's just have a look at what they're talking about. Advising, they're talking about publishing content on online information hubs. Online monitoring and studies. Well, that's what BBC Monitoring does, isn't it?
Yeah.
What else are they talking about? Expert-driven media sources. So they're providing experts whenever there's somebody needed to discuss a particular subject. Fighting online piracy. I'm not quite sure how that fits in quite, but anyway, third-party publishing, mobilization, activism, and counter-activism. So this is what they're into. And we look at some of their people, and we've got people that are describing themselves as experts in online influence. We've got journalists, we've got others. And just look at the number of countries that they say that they work in. So right across the world. And look at who they say their consultants are. Ex-journalists, amongst others, but ex-journalists. So we're finding that people with journalism experience and journalism qualifications no longer working for the newspapers because we don't have an independent media anymore. It's for whatever reason that they want to give, commercial reasons or whatever, their best journalists have been sacked. And what are they doing? They're moving into this type of organization, and instead of producing objective journalism, they're producing paid for content effectively. And in this case, this particular organization was clearly attempting to get some work from the Institute for Statecraft's Integrity Initiative program to try to help produce some more paid-for content.
And we've got BBC Media Action training consultants, in training media people in local areas who are then reporting information back into this wider system. So you've got rid of independent journalists and it's been brought back into this huge control network. Okay, well, one of the stories that several people passed through to us over the last few days, and they were really outraged, was this one, that the Tories reinstated two MPs who'd been suspended for sexual harassment allegations, if that's the right term, sexual inappropriate conduct. I'm sorry, that's the correct wording. So these two men not guilty of anything because the inquiry by Conservative Central Office hadn't been carried out, but Theresa May thought they'd be ideal people to be brought back into the House in order to vote, in order to prop up her leadership. Now, one said he was going to vote for Theresa May in the vote that took place. The other one wasn't saying which way he'd vote. But of course, people said this is outrageous that these two people, in their present status, should be brought back into the House, to which we say this is the state of politics. But credit to this lady, Jess Phillips, because in commenting on this matter, where she said that basically Theresa May had simply let down all of the abuse victims, she was happy to say that Theresa May lied. So we've got a prime minister that it's not just us or other social media that would say the Prime Minister's not telling the truth. We've now got MPs actually prepared to say that that Theresa May is lying. These were her words. Jess Phillips, the Labour MP for Yardley and a campaigner for women who have been abused, said the decision to restore the whip to two men who were still under formal investigation was totally despicable. The message it sends to every person who's complained, those who gave evidence, the COTS inquiry, and every person who's been abused is that the Prime Minister is not on your side. When Theresa May said she wanted Parliament and politics to change, she lied. So brave enough to say that, Mike, but of course it's an accurate message. Theresa May is not on the side of the abuse victims. And this, of course, is why the ICSA inquiry is being run, denying people with evidence of abuse the opportunity to speak in front of that inquiry. Mm. Well, another look at how the media regulates things. This is the BBC talking about the Belgian Prime Minister resigning amid the migration row. This is to do with the UN Marrakesh migration deal, but problems and demonstrations in Belgium have caused enough pressure that there's been a breakdown in the coalition, and so the Prime Minister stepped down. If you read the BBC's article, they simply repeat UN policy. There's no analysis, there's no looking into the rights or wrongs or the benefits or the disadvantages. They simply regurgitate the UN policy. So here's a key bit. The deal, which is not legally binding, seeks an international approach to migration that reaffirms the sovereign rights of states to determine their national migration policy and asserts the fundamental importance of legal migration. The BBC didn't want to talk about the fact that along with this comes a massive and draconian clampdown on free speech, because it's going to eliminate all forms of discrimination, condemn and counter expressions, whatever that means, that's good language, acts and manifestations of racism, racial discrimination, violence, xenophobia, related intolerance against all migrants in conformity with international human rights law. And as we showed a few days ago, I don't need to play this clip, but this was an MEP sitting on a panel in the European Parliament warning that what this UN policy was going to do was to shut down all criticism of migration. And he pointed out that the media themselves would be committing criminal offences if they reported it. The BBC, of course, doesn't cover that component at all.
Right. Facebook back in the news again. This is the New York Times. Apparently, it's all about data privacy practices again. It follows the Cambridge Analytica scandal. They're saying that that they've been sharing data with Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Netflix, Spotify, and Yandex, and in some cases other companies have said that they were not even aware that they had special access, apparently. So again, more promotion of the idea that really we've got to do something about break Facebook up, perhaps. Well, if you watched Monday's UK column news, we were discussing this then, so I would refer people back to that one.
Yeah. So let's come back into where news comes from and how it's being made. And again, I was surprised. Several people flagged this one up. It was the Liverpool Echo running a story. Should Santa be rebranded as gender neutral? We asked people in Liverpool. And just the start of the article was that logo creation company Graphit Springs polled 400 people from the US and UK about potential ways to modernise Santa, using the top suggestions to poll a further 4,000 people on how they envision him. In total, over one quarter, 27% of respondents reckon Father Christmas should be rebranded as female or gender neutral. Now, we were fascinated by this article. We called the Echo to ask who commissioned poll. Was this the Echo itself, or was it Graphic Springs? Now, we did manage to talk to a lady who was quite helpful. She didn't know, and in the time available, the paper couldn't tell us. But you read the article, you're simply unsure as to where this story is actually sprung from. Who commissioned the poll? Who paid for it? Why did they decide to do it? Well, if you try and follow it through by looking at the website, you find a certain amount of information. Here's Graphic Springs, but all they describe themselves as a free logo design software company. You can get in contact with them by email, but I couldn't find any telephone numbers. It wasn't easy to see who the people were behind this company. This gentleman I found, now I can't say that he's still working with them, but I'm just emphasising that to find out more about Graphic Springs, it wasn't simply a case of going to a transparent website. I had to do a little bit of homework, and this gentleman was or is the marketing director, but we don't really know whether it was Graphic Springs decided to do this poll and paid for it themselves or somebody else commissioned it. And of course, the papers don't report. So if you go to their website, encourage you to do that, check for yourself what we're saying is correct. You can find details of the poll as it was carried out. But what is intriguing is that they say they use Google poll services. If we take a look at Google itself, we find that what appeared to be a story carried by the Liverpool Echo has now got 13,200,000 results. And this has now become a worldwide story about how Father Christmas should be more gender neutral, or indeed Mrs. Father Christmas.
So the Liverpool Echo apparently presenting this as their own story, when in fact it's something that was fed to them, which they maybe did a little bit of extra work by sending one of their own reporters out with a microphone, but really it wasn't their story in the first place.
Well, this is the bit I couldn't get to the bottom of. They did send their own reporters out to speak to people in Liverpool. That's certainly true, because you can see the video on the Liverpool Echo side, and it is an Echo microphone being held in front of people. But where does this story, where did it actually originate, and who was so interested in whether we should change the sexual identity of Father Christmas? Well, the BBC, of course, was well into it. So this was BBC Three, gender neutral Santa is coming to town. But if we got into the BBC's article, they, of course, quickly went ultra extreme. So they're suggesting that Santa could be branded as Father Christmas queer. Or the one on the right, they seem to think it was, you know, quite a good thing to have Father Christmas in underwear and suspenders. So just a very strange story. We'd like to know where this story originated, who were the people who decided to put this out, and how did it explode across worldwide media? Is it an important subject? Well, I think the agenda is to get rid of what remains of Christmas, Mike.
Okay, let's end on a bit of financial news. People starting to recognise what's going on, it seems. Here's Bloomberg talking about a stock market rout now in a new and ominous phase. The selling just gets worse. Carnage, these are the types of words that they're using. They make the point that on Monday there were 883 million more shares sold than bought because nobody thinks monetary policy is likely to loosen. Then that was followed up with Zero Hedge. Their headline was the everything bubble has burst. So not just a housing bubble or a stock market bubble, it's an everything bubble. The next crisis is here, and they're saying that the everything bubble has officially burst. The leveraged loan market has officially blown up. The bull market here is over. Things are actually so bad that banks are pulling deals because they're unable to sell loans to investors anymore. The collapse is not reserved to just leverage loans. The entire investment-grade corporate bond market has broken its bull market trend running back to 2010. The financial media is polishing the brass on the Titanic. The whole mess is going down. So a certain amount of recognition of reality, perhaps, in the financial press at the moment. We watch with interest how that develops, and we'll report on it as we can.
Indeed. We just end on a light-hearted note that we were having a look at some of the comments about the UK column that were appearing on a particular blog. And it was very interesting. There was a lot of support for us in some quarters. Other people were saying, well, the trouble is it's all this political stuff and I don't really understand it, so I can't be bothered to watch. or people saying, well, it's not really entertaining what they're giving us. It's all a bit boring. So I prefer to have my entertainment hyped up a bit, to which we will simply say to our audience, we're reporting what we're reporting because it is so serious. And it's vital that people in this country understand what is really happening. We're seeing our institutions absolutely dismantled. We're seeing a very dictatorial government regime come into position. And the loss of our armed forces through EU military unification is, of course, a major event, because it means we simply don't exist as a nation state. We think that's worth reporting in detail in a serious evidence-based way. And we're going to say it's our pleasure to continue to push out the facts as to what's happening. And it's vital that people start to pick up on the information and use it for themselves. So if you're one of the viewers who say, well, I can't handle this, our suggestion is go and do your own research. You're going to need this information to protect your family. We'll leave it there. We'll be back on Friday. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye.